weekly geeky squeak. Yet again, I'm on the road in the final leg,
nearly,
of my 3-week trip around various conferences and friends and family members. Today, I am talking to you from a hotel room in King's Cross. I am overlooking the railways. I can almost see platform 9 3/4 if it existed. Harry Potter fans, perfect spot for train spotters. Although bizarrely, not many trains really come and go. Maybe that says something about the state of British Rail. And also from my window, I can see them building the new Google office, which looks very large and has, even now in its early stages, androids marking floor levels. So, yeah, an area that has certainly changed since I last lived in England. As I have been on the road, a short selection of links for you this week, but also an interview with Simon Harmon, the project lead at Loki, which is an interesting decentralized privacy network, who I spoke with yesterday, actually, also in the hotel room. So quality may be a little up and down, but it's an interesting interview and I wanted to get it out as soon as possible. So let's get started with the links that took my interest this week. First was an article from Dig on Lego. The second Lego film has just been released. I look forward to seeing it eventually. I think in older incarnations of Lego toys, there was this fictional oil company. This article digs into why. Why was there an oil company? And the oil company has changed in recent years and become other things. And this company is also used in the first film to be the kind of evil overlord. And it's just interesting how, you know, even a toy that sometimes is as abstract and as flexible as Lego with its different tie-ins has its own little world, its own little mythos. And it must be a lot of fun creating those sorts of, I don't know what the plural of mythos is, mythi? I'm not sure. Anyway, that's a nice little dig into, if you forgive the pun because it's on Dig, into the story behind this fictional oil company. And then secondly, from The Verge, I spent last week with a friend who had 3 young children, and watching the amount of time they spend on screens is, I mean, even as people who also spend a lot of time on screens, you notice, maybe it's because you notice your own bad habits in young children, but think, you know, they're being manipulated, but I mean, is that any different from us, I guess? So maybe it just challenges your own preconceptions. But obviously, I'm not the only person to have noticed this. And there was an article on The Verge about the screen time debate is pitting parents against each other. And as always with parenting, different opinions on what is the best way to do things. And screen time debate is no exception. Some people rationing it, some people saying it's fine, etc., etc. I'd be interested to know what your opinions are. And if you have children, how you maintain their screen time and how you enforce it. Because, you know, especially as they get older and have their own rooms and things, it's very hard to actually know what they're doing. And second, my ancient relics section, in quote marks. Firstly, was an article from petermee.com about the original Macintosh user manual. I am a technical writer, how I make my money. I don't really write manuals these days. I don't think that many people do anymore. But this original manual of the Macintosh and its sort of wonderful pictures and descriptions and its wonderful waspiness, you know, white Anglo-Saxon Protestant male, of course, that would be very different these days, especially from a company like Apple. But just interesting to see how things have changed and how we used to train people into use computers, whereas now, I think manuals for computers now are basically just plug it in, turn it on, and then off you go. So it was quite interesting to see how that used to be. And then finally, in even older ancient relics, this is an article from The Guardian on the battle for the future of Stonehenge. Stonehenge, the infamous sort of series of stones in the southwest of England. It's always been controversial because the monument, as like many other ancient monuments, needs to be taken care of. And lots of people go to visit. It makes a lot of money for National Heritage here in the UK. But people can't really get very close as you can to some other ancient monuments in the rest of the world. And it's also surrounded by a very busy road, which is my main memory of visiting it when I was younger. So this wonderfully English article has a dig into the people behind the battle for how Stonehenge should be preserved for the future. And there's some great Englishisms in there. Just It feels like an episode of The Archers, Midsummer Murders, and God knows what other British shows all rolled into one, but it's actually real news. So a wonderful read, even if you don't know very much about Stonehenge. And finally, from the Financial Post, 7 excellent ways to start a presentation and capture your audience's attention. I am about to start up again for the year my presentations for conferences. And yeah, there's this sort of first impressions aspect. I mean, first impressions count, but then you also have to keep delivering. But the way you grab people in, especially if they're passing between rooms and just overhearing the starts of talks and things like that, is actually quite important. And there's some really good tips here if you are new or experienced in the field of presentations to how to grab your audience's attention from minute one. That was my roundup of articles from the week. And as promised at the top of the show, next is an interview with Simon Harmon, the project lead at Loki, a decentralized privacy network based out of Melbourne, Australia, actually. I didn't leave it in the interview because it was a bit inside baseball, shall we say. They actually are based very near to where I used to live in Melbourne, and we were talking about some restaurants and things before we got into the real meat of the interview. Interesting project. And actually quite a nice, realistic interview. It's sort of semi-based on blockchain, and so many projects in this space can be very unrealistic with the way they talk about what they do. And Simon was wonderfully refreshing and blunt and honest. Maybe it's the Australian in him. So it was a good interview. Enjoy.
My name's Simon. I'm the project lead at the Loki project, and we're working on a decentralized mixnet. In other words, the bandwidth authorities are decentralized. And decentralized and anonymous messaging application that allow you to send a message in such a way that not even the servers that are hosting your messages know that you are sending those messages, primarily because they're scattered and it's also being routed through that mixnet that I mentioned earlier. Loki is also a private cryptocurrency that's integrated into the system through service nodes, and the service nodes are also the computers that host the messages and run the mixnet. So it's kind of an intertwined privacy ecosystem, you could say.
So let's actually go back one step, because from my understanding anyway, which is loose, this sounds a little like something like Tor. Is that correct?
It is a lot like Tor in a lot of ways. Parts of it are anyway. So the service node network that's created through interactions with the Loki cryptocurrency. This whole thing came about because we were wondering what we could do with master Monero as well, I think is a worthwhile point. But we were looking at them and going, well, okay, so how can you improve the user experience through the use of master nodes? I mean, Dash's instant pay was a pretty obvious one. Oh, cool, you can now send payments with instant confirmation times. And that was all great, well and great, and we were thinking about doing a version on Monero with that. But we were then thinking, well, what else can this strongly incentivized group of nodes do that also has a built-in voting mechanism to regulate their behavior on the chain? We were thinking, well, why can't you do it off the chain? So that sort of led us down a rabbit hole where we were exploring Mixnet and private messaging and what some of the problems were with that, and how this could actually solve it. And where we landed is that masternodes are effectively a cyber attack resistance mechanism. And the one huge glaring flaw in the Tor network is that it is not at all cyber attack resistant. If you have enough relays, you can basically watch what everyone's doing at any given time. My back of the notepad calculations put the cost of cyber attacking the Tor network at about $40,000 to $50,000 per month, which to various security agencies around the world and actually quite a large number of countries, that's peanuts. Sometimes if there was a particular Tor user that you wanted to watch, it might even be economically viable to cyber attack the Tor network just to look at one person. That's how cheap it is. And because obviously there's a lot of money being spent on high-profile investigations, so you know $50,000 for a couple months is really not a lot of money when you have a team of investigators already working on it. It's about the same, in fact. So I would say that the main thing that Loki has over Tor and over the mixed nets is that it has this built-in element of cyber attack resistance. The downside, of course, is that Loki net is a brand new mixed net. It's quite untested at the moment. It's stable. Some weeks it is, some weeks it's not. And it's not currently launched on that service node network. But there are a number of other advantages. We've rebuilt a mixnet protocol from scratch. One of our developers, Jeff, has been working on ITP for a number of years now and basically wanted to ask the question, how would ITP look if it was built in the modern day? And the result is the underlying protocol behind LokiNet, which is called LARP, or Low Latency Anonymous Routing Protocol. And that is essentially, instead of having this thing where we only allow TCP connections and we use SOX proxies and things like that to make the Tor network work, instead it's basically just straight up IP tunneling. So very similar to a lot of VPNs. And what that means is that everything, just about everything, works straight out of the box. So if you wanted to, you could do all sorts of things, host any number of applications that rely on various ports. You could run any number of cryptocurrencies, for example, is a good example, where you have a large group of daemons. Sometimes they need their ports forwarded. You could host those daemons within LokiNet, and it would be anonymized on the transport layer. In other words, the IP address is hidden. And that's a pretty cool functionality that just works right out of the box. So there's some protocol upgrades happening there as well.
And so is the main mechanism for preventing the attacks the voting, or is
it's not the voting? It's the fact that the operators involved need to have a stake in the network in order to become a relay. So unlike in Tor, where literally anyone can just turn a server on and then run it, and then slowly over time the bandwidth authorities assign them roles as relays and guards and exits and entry nodes and all of that sort of stuff. Instead, in this, they're authenticated by their stake. So if the network catches them doing something nefarious or not behaving themselves, not routing traffic properly, they can be voted off. So that there's two things happening. One is they require a stake, which prevents a single actor coming in and purchasing large amount of network, especially if the lockup of the circulating supply is above 50%, which at the moment it's currently getting very close to. Because then it becomes nearly impossible to acquire enough in order to cyber attack the network. And secondly, there's that voting mechanism in place where if someone is trying to take down the network, there are built-in mechanisms to kick those nodes off such that they lose their authentication privileges and are no longer allowed to be relays on the network.
And I guess let's go back a step out of the technical details.
Sure.
Why create this in the first place? What problem were you trying to solve from yourself or from other people you'd worked with?
Well, myself and the other people involved in the project, as I mentioned before, we were really keen on Monero, and we've been keen on Tor and various other privacy projects for a long time. Like, I think the most attractive thing for me is the protection of the freedom of speech. I mean, I think nothing showcases this better than the appearance of all of this censorship that's happening on Patreon and all this deplatforming of various content creators. Like, say what you will about those people, but that's not what the internet is about. The internet is about a free and open exchange of ideas, however batshit crazy they might be sometimes. And I think that handing over the reins of this thing that was once quite free and quite beautiful to these corporations that based on a political agenda, or and that can go either way, whether you sit on the left or the right, like this should be a matter of concern to you. It's where at the whim of whatever a corporation or a particular group of people within a corporation deem to be acceptable can just be flicked on or off. And that's not what made the internet. That's not what made it what it is today. That's not why we all use it. And I think without the existence of private platforms, amongst other reasons as well, I mean, another thing I think is that privacy and security go hand in hand. There's no point securing something if the information that you're trying to secure is not. something that you want to keep to yourself or keep hidden. I think that while the Bitcoin blockchain might be secure in that sense, because it's not private, you automatically lose these about information. So there's a number of things happening here. I mean, there's also a humanitarian angle where you have oppressive governments and what have you censoring things as well, which is obviously not something we think about a lot here in the West, but happens all the time overseas, especially in places like Iran. And, you know, it's tools like this that help journalists and out there without being interfered by various governments. So all these privacy technologies are very interesting to me for all of these reasons. And I think the more people that work on these problems, the better. So that's what attracted them to me in the first place.
So forgive me if this is a slightly ignorant question, but I know some blockchains already suffer from this problem of being dominated by particular groups through their, you know, incentive algorithms, their consensus algorithms, whatever the problem may be. So how do you stop the same thing happening with Loki, in that it may not be a corporation, but it may be a group of people with a particular agenda who gather enough influence on the network to block certain opinions? And how, and I guess from a governance perspective, how do you step in and say that's not wrong, that's not right, or do you let them do it?
So everything we design with the philosophy of privacy by default. So actually almost everything that the node operators touch, so messages, internet traffic, or transactions, they can't actually see the content of those transactions. And most of the time they don't know where it's come from. And most of the time, or they either know where it's come from or where it's going. One of the two, they never know both at the same time. So immediately the censorship aspect of things stops becoming a problem, because unless you're doing a blanket attack on the network where you're blocking all traffic, you're not going to be able to sift through that information and find out what you want to block or who you want to block, because you just don't know who they are. And I think that's a very important aspect of privacy that a lot of people in the blockchain space just seem to ignore. I mean, if you look at Zcash and a number of the Zerocoin and Zerocash protocol coins out there, I mean, Zcash in particular, I heard an updated number recently. I'm not sure if this is true, but it's somewhere between 92 and 98% of all transactions are completely in the clear. I mean, if they're in the clear, they can also be censored. So there's sort of not really a point in that. If you're going to have privacy, it needs to be by default, because otherwise you're really supporting that anti-censorship side of things, or really enabling privacy at all. I mean, in Zcash, the privacy data set isn't really a huge issue because it's cryptography based as opposed to obfuscation based like Loki and Monero and others are. But it still stands to the point that, you know, Zcash isn't really used a lot for the purpose that it was set out for.
So what is visible? Is there a public ledger at all? Or
yeah, there's a public ledger. You just won't know how to interpret it unless you have the correct keys. So it's kind of it's hidden in plain sight, if you will. We use a number of techniques, which I can go into if you like, but it can get a bit.
Yeah, sure.
Well, I mean,
maybe high level ish.
Yeah. What are you most interested in? I mean, I could talk about the currency side of things, or I could talk about the internet traffic side of things. I could talk about the message.
Actually,
side.
More on the traffic, I think. Maybe we'll go to the currency side in a second, but the traffic, yeah. How are you securing that?
Well, very similar to other mixnets out there, Tor being the primary example. Mm-hmm. We use a method called onion routing to secure the traffic as it's being transported through these various nodes. And how it works is you randomly select three nodes on the network, and you wrap up the thing that you want to send across, to a packet of information in these layers. And this is where it gets its name from, because you have an outer layer, a middle layer, and an inner layer. And so, and then you have the information that you actually want. So what happens is you pass this bundle of layers to the first node, and through their public key, they're able to unwrap the first layer and see what's beneath it. And in that second layer will be information telling them where to send the bundle to next. And then the third node repeats that, and they unwrap the inner layer and see where you actually want to go on the internet. Now, the cool thing about this process is that the first node only knows where you are and the middle node are. The middle node only knows where they are. And the last node only knows where the middle node is and where you want to go. No one in that path is able to construct a complete image of the traffic. And you can extend that further by adding more hops in your path. So if you go from three nodes to, say, seven, then you're creating a number of stops between you and the last node to make it even more difficult to predict where you are in the network. So that's kind of how traffic gets obfuscated. Now, that becomes an issue if someone owns more than 30 or 40% of the nodes, because there's a reasonably good chance that they'll make up two of the three of the nodes that in any given circuit. So if that's the case, then they can generally build a complete picture of the circuit that's being used. So you only really need 30 to 40% of the nodes in order to be able to effectively analyze the traffic, which is why the cyber attack issue is such a big thing and why we think that LokiNet is superior to other mixed nets out there for that reason.
Yeah, yeah. And so the token is the incentivization, the payment, as it were, for hosting a node.
Not the payment, it's actually the reward. There's actually been quite a bit of discussion in the Loki community recently about how the token fits into that model. So our thinking was, when we started this, because we came at this from the currency perspective, that if we were able to successfully create this mixnet and create the messenger and also have this cryptocurrency that was doing advanced things such as instant private transactions through Blink, for example, that Loki, the currency itself, would be valuable, and running a node on that network would be a desirable thing, because you'd be earning this currency and also staking it. And then through the usage of the currency and through you manage to drive network value by having the store value between users purchasing it and merchants selling it. So in that gap, or however long people hold onto it, is where the value is captured. So that was the original model that we went with. But there's now been another school of thought that's come along more recently, which is to turn Loki not exclusively into a utility token. We still want to do the currency side of things, but to help that process along by also introducing somewhat of a freemium model. So there are some things in the network that are pretty taxing to do, such as routing certain types of information, or, for example, creating large group chats within the messenger, because it's a distributed architecture that's actually quite taxing on the network. So we were thinking of creating this private authentication token that can anonymously authenticate various users that pay for this. I use the word token in the way that most cryptocurrency people will find confusing. Let's call it a access pass. Something like that. For a set amount of time, you have certain privileges on the network that allow you to do extra things that most users wouldn't want, but you might. And through that way, we can offset inflation that's created through service node rewards, because these tokens would be burned, and also provide advanced users with more features that would be desirable. So there's kind of a hybrid value capture system at play that we can see working.
Okay. And actually, just another, before we dig into a bit more detail of the platform, another sort of point of comparison, I guess. So to me, so far, well, not necessarily on the kind of the privacy side, but on the platform side, it seems a little familiar to something like status, or in terms of the, like, the platform side. I mean, there's a lot of these sort of blockchain operating systems, which... operating system is maybe a bit of a strong word, but that's the term they use.
Yeah.
So is there some similarity there in the ability to create kind of, useful applications on top of the platform?
So a lot of the stuff that Loki does won't actually touch the blockchain, which is actually a really nice feature. So we have something called Snaps, which other people that in the mixnet world would probably also describe as hidden services. There's we're thinking about expanding that beyond just being able to create these hidden applications within the network that you have to host yourself, to something where the service nodes could host it for you and there would be a payment system involved in that. But what we want that to be is very open and very easy. So literally any web application or website can be hosted as a snap within LokiNet. And that means that your service hidden and all of the clients that use it are hidden as well on a network level. So it's a really cool feature. We're also thinking about integrating a public key authentication API so we can do away with emails and phone numbers when we want to use stuff. We can actually just use a public private key pair like you would through an SSH client or something like that, or you know, your Bitcoin wallet or whatever else you have to authenticate yourself onto various services and that sort of thing. So that's something else we're thinking about. But when I've looked at, I guess you'd call them competing blockchain projects, I don't actually think that they're competing in any real sense, because none of them are really touching the privacy space in the way that we are. As far as I'm aware, I can't remember exactly what Status is doing. I know it's quite popular and they've got this messaging application, but I think because they're tied to what I understand to be an ERC-20 token, I don't see the anonymity backing behind it. I think there's going to be a lot of metadata issues associated with that. And as far as I can tell, I'm not sure how far they've gotten with actually dealing with anonymity as a real concern with their application. And there's a number of other projects that are dealing with similar sorts of things, like Mainframe is another one that I know that claimed to be doing this dark routing thing that was never really substantiated as far as I'm aware. There's also another project, the name of which is Orchid Protocol, I think it was called. Mm-hmm. They raised some ungodly amount of money at around about the same time as we were, and we're essentially going to build a mixnet that you had to pay to use through cryptocurrency. Mm-hmm. And it now looks like they've dropped off the radar completely. So if I was investing in them, I'd probably want to know what's going on, because it doesn't look like there's a lot happening. So no, I don't really see any direct competitors to what we're doing. I haven't really seen anyone addressing the specific concerns that we are, or targeting the audience that we are.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So how do people build these snaps?
Sorry, one sec. Is my audio like really right now? Probably is.
Yeah, it's jumping a little. Yeah.
Yeah.
I just assumed it was.
My apologies, my sound card flipped out. Does that sometimes.
That's fine. How do people build the snaps?
As I said, snaps are literally any web application or website. So if you have a website, say a WordPress site, or if you have let's go something more advanced. Let's say an e-commerce platform that integrates cryptocurrencies into the payment methods that, I don't know, you tell me, like literally any web application will work. So long as it can be rendered in a browser, you can host it as a snap. And actually, you can do far more than that as a snap. We have an IRC server that's running as a snap. We have a Mumble server that's running as a snap. Like, literally almost anything that connects to the internet can be hosted as a snap, and it's actually really easy. We have one page of documentation on how to run a snap, because it's literally that simple. Okay. And most things work right out of the box. There's no need to configure routers. There's no need to do anything funny to the operating system, because what we've done is we've hijacked operating system's DNS system so that what we do is the daemon that you run when you use LokiNet, it listens for when you call the .loki domain. So if I type in WordPress, mywordpress.loki, it will forget that the rest of the internet exists, and it will shove everything to do with that connection over LokiNet, because it's been told to do it over .loki, and then I will use LokiNet to find out what my WordPress means or whatever address you put in there means. And so it will create a path and it will go there. And the operating system doesn't need to know about it. The specific hardware you're using doesn't need to know about it. The application that you're serving doesn't need to know about it either. It's all just shoved through IP tunneling. It's actually quite eloquent.
And what sort of things have you tested? I mean, you mentioned a couple there, but are there any that have worked especially well, or any that you hoped would work better, or any particular applications that work best, I guess?
Nothing works as well as it does over the actual internet, because we are running it through these nodes. So we're adding like a second of latency just straight out of the gate to every connection that we make, which is obviously not ideal, but that's how mixed nets work. Sort of a fundamental issue that can't really be fixed. And also the protocol is quite young, so there's a few things that have to be redone, rejigged, optimized in order to make it faster. But at the moment, we're actually thinking about doing this this video where we basically get Jeff and a couple of the other developers to have a challenge to find the application that doesn't work on LokiNet first. So they're going to go through a list of just whatever they can find and see if it will run on LokiNet. And their assumption is that pretty much everything will, which is kind of cool.
But just quickly looking at your roadmap, it's
implying the roadmap that needs updating. Yeah, that one.
Okay, so it says quarter one 2019, which I guess we are in. So yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, cool. Actually, it just occurred to me that the naming of things is strange, because you've got Snaps, which is also a canonical project, which could be confusing. Although it's the ability to install an application, kind of any application. So the only issue you might run into is potential copyright. I don't know if they have that sort of thing.
Snaps? I'm not aware of this.
Yes. Snaps is a canonical packaging format as well.
Is
it? With 1S, though. Oh, no, yours is also with 1S, yeah. Yeah.
With?
I don't know.
I'll have to look that up later. Okay, fair enough.
And then being a role player, LARP also jumps out at me, but you have to got double L there. So
yeah. Look, I'll be honest, I didn't come up with that one. All those proprietary Simon Harmon invention, stay away.
But I mean, actually, on the subject of naming, where did the name come from? Because I mean, Loki has certain connotations that, you know, tricksters and things like that. I mean, I don't know if the name sometimes might, I don't know. It may be.
You think it's a bit shady, a bit mischievous? Yeah. Yeah, that's fair enough. Well, that's actually kind of why we picked the name. We were having a real hard time picking the name. And the technique the currency uses to obfuscate transactions is pretty much just trickery. It's like, here's a bunch of transactions that could be existing, and then only one of them actually is. So, like, trickery is built into how the currency works. So we thought that the Norse god of trickery was actually quite a fitting title for it, you know. And also, it's low key. Oh dear. Yeah.
Yeah. All right. So let's go back to, we mentioned the roadmap needs updating. So I guess mostly you're on time right now.
Yeah, well, LokiNet and Snaps and not quite the messenger yet, but they all exist. They're just not deployed on the mainnet. Yeah, you can go on there right now and join the IRC chat and see what secret things are going on there. See what weirdos are hanging out.
Secret things can be going on.
Well, that's right. I mean, so if you can get to it, it's not
quarter
that secret.
Quarter two is LokiNet exit functionality. What does that mean?
So that means where we enable a feature on all service nodes where you can use them to access the wider internet anonymously. So just like you would use a commercial VPN service to, well, ideally you'd be using a commercial VPN service to access the internet without really your IP address. You can do exactly the same thing with Loki service nodes, except in my opinion, it's far more secure because you're not relying on just one person to render that connection. You're actually doing it in a decentralized and trustless way. Which is pretty cool. It's just like Tor. So when you use Tor to access, you know, YouTube or Reddit or whatever, and to hide your IP address for whatever reason, same deal, same things going on, except you're using LokiNet to do it. And ideally, eventually it will be faster because we'll have nodes that are incentivized to provide a minimum standard of bandwidth. So no matter which node you connect to, you should have a pretty good bandwidth throughput.
Okay. And then what's not necessarily what's on the roadmap, but what are your ideas for the future after that's done?
Oh, so many ideas. I think that this year is going to be quite a slow year, actually. I think I think people underestimate how much it takes to build these things. Like a brand new MixNet protocol is not something that happens overnight. Jeff's been working on it since the start of last year, and it's only really just coming out of its sort of alpha phase at the moment. And the messenger as well, Loki Messenger, is actually coming along quite well, but it's sort of one of those things that needs to have all the features you want right out of the gate. It's not something you can build up progressively because people have come to expect a certain minimum standard through their messaging applications. So they want to be able to use the messenger across all of their devices and it sync relatively easily. They want messages to come through and be reasonably stable. They don't want it. They want to be able to control their messages, delete them, all that sort of stuff. Emojis, support for, you know, all these things that we've just come to expect of our chat applications, which if we look back to the MSN days, is like absolutely unbelievable that we can have all this stuff and have it be so stable and accessible all the time. Yeah. We don't want our anonymous messaging system, secure though it may be, to be like a horrible user experience. We want it to at least be comparable. I mean, it is going to be slower once again because we're routing everything through three nodes and then they're connecting to this service node, which is propagating the message through a swarm, and then someone's going to go back into that swarm to find their message and collect it. Or they have to do a two-way, three-hop connection to establish a peer-to-peer connection, and they've got to find out if they're online and everything else. So the back-end architecture is a lot more complicated than other messaging applications out there, which is literally just like, oh, hey, WhatsApp, send me my messages. Or, hey, Facebook, tell me what's going on right now. That's all the back-end that goes on client-side on most messaging applications. But that is simply not the case with Loki Messenger. So it's going to take a fair bit of time to get that working. And the other really annoying thing that's really getting my goat at the moment is that it doesn't look like there's a way of getting around having to create native applications for both Android and iOS and desktop, meaning we have to separately develop three separate implementations of this messaging application across three different platforms, which makes me very upset, but that's fine. We've almost finished with the desktop now, so it should be fairly easy to just copy across the changes that we made there onto the Signal mobile and both of the mobile platforms. So it should be fairly straightforward. It's just going to be a matter of time.
Okay. And you have a reasonable team and some funding. So is everybody working on this full time or... Is it
absolutely bits and pieces? We have 19 staff full time at the moment. And that doesn't look likely to change. We've got a fair amount of runway, probably 3 to 4 years, depending on unknown costs. So we're fairly confident that we'll be able to deliver everything that we said we'd do in our white paper and then some, which is exciting. Mm-hmm. The real question is whether or not when we actually do finish these products, sort of starting halfway through this year, sort of ending at the end of this year, are we actually going to be able to drive the adoption and the excitement around these products that we were hoping? And I think that's really what's going to make or break Loki over the next sort of 18 months, to see whether or not people actually find the story compelling, find the products compelling. And I think one of the biggest things that is of concern to me is whether or not the privacy community really advocates for it, because I think that's really the only way that this is going to go anywhere, is if they see the work that we've done, they analyze the assumptions that we've made, they verified the security of the specific implementations that we've done, and they go, yep, this is probably the most secure messaging platform on the market right now. And if that happens, then we should see you know, very high numbers of adoption, but if it doesn't, and that's my concern, and I also don't know how to get that. So that's sort of the biggest challenge for Loki, I think, is to get that technical endorsement from the privacy community.
Well, on that note, I mean, obviously mainnet has only just kind of happened, but do you have active users, or is it mostly test users right now?
Well, the mainnet, the Loki cryptocurrency mainnet, launched in May last year, so I wouldn't exactly say it's
the cryptocurrency. The fresh currency, okay.
Yeah, the cryptocurrency has been going for a little while now. We launched service nodes in September, which has been going really well. We've gotten 400 and something service nodes up online at the moment, which means that we actually have 40% of our circulating supply locked up there, which is exciting. As far as the testnet side of things goes with LokiNet, we have had bursts of activity as we've released certain things and released certain guides. But, you know, as with everything, if it's not a whole ecosystem, it does tend to die down a little bit. But, yeah, I think things look pretty promising. We've got a fair few passionate community members that talk a lot in our chats and contribute to what's going on and speak their mind about ideas about how we can improve the ecosystem and expand things when they're ready, which is exciting. But yeah, I think the challenge is, especially in this cryptocurrency market at the moment, without a finished product, it's basically impossible to go to a mainstream audience and say, hey, you should be excited about this thing that doesn't yet exist. So I think for everyone that's developing blockchain-based projects at the moment, I think they will largely be experiencing the same thing. If they're trying to market to existing cryptocurrency users, they're marketing in an extremely saturated environment where there's just thousands of projects and it's very disorienting. Or if they're trying to go to a mainstream market, they'll be going to market with these very nascent products that have very untested, a lot of user experience issues. And you know, this is all very normal in the startup world, but I think cryptocurrency users are very, very impatient just because how quickly things can change. They want to know that the bets that they've placed are going to pay off sooner rather than later. And I think that's probably quite an unrealistic expectation considering how, you know, Bitcoin itself took, you know, 5 years to build before it gained any sort of traction. And many other popular applications on the internet today are exactly the same. They take years to actually polish and refine and develop this organic user base. But then again, you know, then there's these so-called killer apps like, you know, your Snapchats of the world that just show up one day and then blow up over a course of months and all of a sudden everyone's using it. But that just hasn't happened in the blockchain world yet. And I see no reason why it will, because inherently blockchain applications are going to be a worse user experience. So if you're competing with something that's already out there that's easy to use, you're not really targeting a mainstream audience and you shouldn't try to, in my opinion. And I'm not sure Loki fits within that mainstream market or not. I mean, everyone's got a need to use a secure messenger every now and then, whether it's to talk about a sensitive matter with a with a family member about something, or you know, some business transactions or anything like that. There's always times in our lives where we need privacy, but I'm not sure that that's going to be something that people use every day. I'm not sure if it's going to be something that's very compelling to the everyday person. So my opinion is we need to be quite targeted about it, at least at first.
Yeah, no, it's an interesting perspective. I mean, I think sometimes the blockchain community has this tendency to try and over push things, and it's not like, you know, the Kubernetes or Docker community was going around telling everybody that everyone should be using this.
You know? Exactly.
It's a particular use case. Yeah, it's actually an interesting perspective and a realistic perspective. Obviously, if you're pitching to investors and things, it's a little more challenging sometimes because they want to see growth. But yeah.
Well, yeah, I mean,
it's actually a refreshing perspective to hear.
And from the investment perspective as well, I think they also have quite an unrealistic expectation, because what a lot of them have done is they've come from the startup world where, you know, it's basically expected that if you don't have a minimum viable product, you won't be successful in your Series A funding. You might get seed funding if you're lucky. You generally won't, though. So generally speaking, developers go to investors with all products that already work and they can already start to give to users. Whereas in the blockchain space, and Loki is just, we come to them with these very, often very advanced technical documents and these lavish ideas about these ecosystems. And then we ask for a bunch of money and then they give it to us and wonder why they haven't been built in 6 months' time. It's just because it, it doesn't work like that. If you start from nothing and you want to build a really advanced product that's not going to work until it's finished, it's not going to happen in 6 months, especially. And this is the worst thing about it, is when they give money to these people that have zero developers on their team. They have very little technical credentials. And I think actually Loki at the very beginning was also guilty of this, because we didn't, it wasn't obvious that we had the technical know-how, how to pull off what we were talking about. And it's only through hiring that we've managed to do that. But I think, all of these projects that came in 2017, 2018, that I think very little work was done to make sure that it was actually technically feasible, because a lot of these projects is just not.
Yeah. That's actually a really refreshing perspective to hear. And I think if anything comes out of the crypto winter, as it's called, as it's being called, is that we actually end up with people who are actually interested in the right things, decent projects that actually have some use, and focusing more on the interesting applications of the technology. The incentivization mechanisms are useful, but I think we got too...
Yeah, I think there are means to an end. And if you don't have a good end, which most of them don't, it was just, oh, incentives, cool. And then that was about as far as the discussion got. It's like, well, proof of stake, fantastic. What are you going to do with proof of stake? Where does it get you? You know? I think you're right.
And that was another Weekly Squeak for the week. Thanks to all the people who have been subscribing over the past couple of weeks. Much appreciated. If you are new or old to the show and the newsletter, you can find previous episodes on my new website at christianchiller.com/podcast/newsletters, depending on your preference. And you can support the show at christianchiller.com/support. And you can tweet at me at chrischinch and find all my other contact details on the website. So in the meantime, if you have been, thank you very much for listening.